A Washington Post investigation revealed that of all fatal shootings by police in 2015, almost one quarter involved a person who was mentally unstable. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 4th to hear St. Helens Police Chief Terry Moss discuss how crisis intervention training is changing how police interact with people with mental illness and how police are helping to divert them from incarceration. That's Prison Pipeline, April 4th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Eco Plumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or gray water harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 4th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Joseph Goodman of the Rocky Mountain Institute. He works in distributed energy, in which cities combine small solar panel and small wind turbine installations with smallish utility-scale plants to meet the city's energy needs. This is on homes, schools, offices, right-of-ways, and more. This array would replace corporate big plant, big grid, big cost systems as favored by investor-owned utilities. The IOUs, like PGE and Pacific Power, are doing all they can to stop distributed energy, and Bill and Joseph Goodman discuss distributed energy and how it could come to Portland. Lori Mercier talks with Cindy Weisner, National Coordinator of Grassroots Global Justice, about the Alliance, its work, the Our Power campaign, and in particular, how we link climate justice organizing with other movements and why this is important. Weisner will speak in Vancouver, Washington on Friday, April 8th at Washington State University, Vancouver, Center for Social and Environmental Justice Conference. The conference's Environmental and Climate Justice Practices, Weisner's presentation, Frontline Communities at COP21 and Beyond, is at 2:30 p.m. and is free and open to the public. We'll have more information about that during the program. Desiree Helgers interviews sociologist Rick Scarce. He's the author of the landmark study, Eco Warriors, Understanding the Radical Environmental Movement. They talk about the history and future of radical environmental organizing and about his new book, Creating Sustainable Communities, Lessons from the Hudson River Region. Scarce is speaking on Trajectories of Injustice, Three Decades of Radicalism, Environmentalism, on April 8th at Washington State University, Vancouver. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, we turn to Bill Resnick and Joseph Goodman.
Joseph Goodman, welcome to KBOO.
It's great to be on the call with you today, Bill, and having an opportunity to speak with your listeners in Oregon. I've had great opportunities to travel the state. I'm a big fan of some of your towns like Corvallis, and generally honored to be here.
Joseph Goodman is the manager of the SHINE Project of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado. The institute works worldwide. Joseph Goodman left a nice 10-year position in the engineering department at Georgia Tech, studying alternative renewable energy, all the technical details. He left for the wilds of Colorado, that is the Rocky Mountain Institute and the SHINE Project. Joseph Goodman, tell us why you changed employment and what does SHINE do? Why are you doing it besides getting out of beautiful Atlanta?
Well, Bill, you know, I was excited to come out to Colorado and work with Rocky Mountain Institute for two main reasons: the access to the wilderness and the impact that the Rocky Mountain Institute has. I went to school in California and roamed the West for 5 years while I was out there, traveling the deserts of Southwest California, the Oregon and Washington coast, and you know, spent great time out in the Olympic Peninsula. But most importantly, when I was in academia, I saw that we were moving things forward, you know, incrementally making things better, but that in reality, industry was ready to take off. You know, it was ready to get technologies out of the lab and into the hands of consumers where we're affecting their pocketbooks and quality of life.
You mean the technologies were ready really to go worldwide and you wanted to speed that up? Is that, and you wanted to be part of that great expansion?
Exactly. I was funded for 5 years by the U.S. Department of Energy to help reduce solar balance of systems cost. We took out 75% of the racking hardware and labor for PV systems. So we've had huge technological advancements, and there's real economic savings to be had now with solar electricity. Communities can install solar electricity and generate energy below wholesale rates. So right now, it's the lowest cost solution for many communities in the country.
Really? Communities can do it. For example, a community in Oregon where the wind is not terribly strong, but there's some parts of it, I suppose, but where there's a lot of clouds, it's still going to be the case that they can produce energy at competitive rates with the wholesale market?
Right now, it's still case by case as we go around the U.S., and probably even within Oregon, there's some variation in local rates. But we're seeing, for example, we're supporting communities in upstate New York and central New York, some of the cloudiest places in the country, adopt community solar. And the reason they're doing it is because of the economic security that it provides. That includes day one savings, measured or flat escalation rates out into the future, and economic development opportunity. Solar energy in the community puts people to work. So, Bill, when we look at some of the differences between community-scale solar and, you know, larger utility-scale projects, first, before we get into it, let's recognize we really want to live in a world where there's all of the above. I'll take utility-scale solar projects any day. They're going to offset huge amounts of CO2 emissions, SOx emissions, and benefit, you know, my children, my climate, and my bill. At the same time, community-scale solar offers incredible opportunity for local economic development. RMI has defined community-scale solar to be systems between 0.5 megawatt and 5 megawatts, where a 5-megawatt system serves about 1,000 households. The system would cost, you know, $5 to $7.5 million. And put local people to work building, operating, and maintaining the system for 25 years at minimum, and more likely 40 years. Many communities around the country are adopting community scale solar, you know, not only for the economic savings, but also for the economic development opportunities. For example, when we look at Rochester, New York, Rochester is one of the most poor communities in the nation. It has the third most census tracts in poverty. And Rochester is trying to develop community solar with the intent of creating jobs, economic stability, and combating transiency in its population. The cities behind it, local nonprofits and businesses and even universities are all collaborating to bring online community scale solar. They're going to be successful. They're going to see economic savings and the economic development that they are so focused on achieving.
You know, it seems to me there's also enormous other benefits to community solar, even if they aren't cheaper than the wholesale rate from the IOUs. I mean, they're always competitive and at the same rate. I mean, they're in the same ballpark. But there's so many other advantages, it seems to me, in terms of security and reliability, in terms of not being dependent on the grid that can always go out. And the grids, these big grids, high volume grids, are getting so expensive, and they have to be highly securitized for a lot of reasons, some of them just the huge storms that we're expecting, unprecedentedly large storms that could blow down or somehow destroy much of the grids or flood parts of it out. There are other real good reasons for community solar too, besides their cheapness and their flat rate, and once they're in, and the costs are not going up. How do you explain that to cities?
So the question I hear you asking is, in what ways is community scale solar contributing to the resiliency of cities, and how is that message effectively communicated? Around the country, we see examples of communities adopting community scale solar for the benefits of improved resiliency to local households and local economy. This trend started really in response to Fukushima, where there were households that were offline for extended times, and there was solar panels that were not producing because the grid was down. And in response to that, industry has evolved to enable solar arrays, even on residential arrays, to do what's called islanding, where they continue to supply power to the household or business. And now people are installing solar at their homes and businesses for the security of being able to continue to produce and power their critical loads, like your refrigerator and lights, when the grid is down. Another way we see communities taking advantage of the resiliency opportunities of community scale solar is by developing microgrids that use community scale solar as the generation asset, the source of energy. In some cases, they're combining solar with storage or other solutions. But they're building the infrastructure so that the whole community or all the critical infrastructure can access the energy generated by a local array. So, for example, there's communities who have said, we need to protect our elderly. We should make old age homes part of a microgrid circuit. We need to protect our critical infrastructure, like fire departments and hospitals, and they get brought into a microgrid circuit. In some neighborhoods as well.
I didn't really appreciate that. I knew it was more resilient, but of course, when you think of all of those services that have to continue, they have to continue. This is KBU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Joseph Goodman, who is an academic researcher, bringing down the costs of bringing down by, as he pointed out, 75% of the costs, and they're still going down, of local energy, of distributed energy, residential energy, community energy. There's a variety of different modes of renewable energy production at the community level. But he took a job at the Rocky Mountain Institute promoting and helping communities establish community energy. We've been talking about the many, many advantages of community energy. There's one additional advantage I think that's so important. It's really the major one that's not talked about very much, but you do, which is why your articles are so interesting, is that when people in the community begin developing their own energy system, they also, because they're, for a variety of reasons, they also develop cultures that support clean energy in so many other ways, like changing transit systems, more biking, generally cultures that are sensitive to the need to conserve energy for a variety of reasons. Because you're conserving all of the resources, because it's so much cheaper, and because it creates a much healthier life. When you get those kinds of communities where those values become central, that's like about three quarters of the battle, because once they start conserving energy, greenhouse gas emissions just plummet downwards.
Bill, I had the great opportunity to work with one of our great national parks, Yellowstone. And it was a long, multi-year process. But we had the great success of getting a PV array installed at a national park building in Yellowstone. Now, there was a slight delay on the interconnection, you know, which was actually turning the system on. But we noticed a great anomaly that before we ever turned the system on, energy consumption in the building reduced by about 20%. So we looked into this and said, how could this happen, right? What's the science? What's the technology that supports this? And what we walked away with was actually we incited social and behavioral change just by putting PV in the community where it was visible and was able to really create hope and a sense of empowerment. So what happened was, wasn't any phenomenon of physics. It was a phenomenon of behavior. People saw solar and they changed their behavior. They turned off the lights. They set back the thermostats. They closed the windows at the end of the day. They generally enjoyed their environment more and started to conserve.
That was the workers there, I suppose, mostly. But are you also talking about the visitors who came in? Did they somehow behave in a way that was more sensitive to energy issues?
The load associated with that building was mostly associated with workers. However, one of the key reasons that Yellowstone National Park was so motivated and felt it was such an obligation to install solar in visible locations was because when visitors from around the U.S. and around the world come to Yellowstone National Park, they are in such a position to kind of take in new ideas and adopt new behavior. And so when they see that our national parks are doing solar, many, many visitors go home and think, wow, we can do this at home too. We can do this at our house. We can do it in our communities or in other nations.
Yeah, I remember reading a piece that when a community has one or two solar panels on roofs, the third and the fourth go up slowly, and it's a very slow thing, but growth. But when there's a 10 or 20, when it starts really sort of moving and people see it a lot, suddenly you get this huge spurt of growth of residential solar, business solar, all of the other forms of energy production and conservation.
So there's absolutely a peer-to-peer effect in the adoption of solar. That there have been studies examining the proliferation of rooftop solar, and they found that if your neighbor or somebody else in your block has solar on their rooftop, you're more likely to adopt solar on your rooftop. Solar has been around as a kind of a scientific phenomenon for about a half a century now. And, you know, there's been so many myths and data points kind of published and disseminated in the media. And so our popular understanding of the maturity of the technology absolutely lags the state of the art that's available today when you call up your local installer and tell them you're ready to switch to clean, reliable solar energy that saves you money. Another interesting peer-to-peer effect that we see is that many of the leading communities, including co-ops, municipalities, even urban co-ops, have shown us how you can adopt solar at the local level or at the level that you can influence. And there's models out there all through the U.S. to show how this is feasible today. There's examples of solarized campaigns for getting more solar on rooftops, community buildings and municipal buildings. There's examples of how cities that had a strong environmental ethic and concern for economic prosperity have switched through community choice aggregation, despite being under control of large IOUs.
Yeah. An IOU is an investor-owned utilities. Even though they're powerful in a community, still they can be pushed.
You don't have to push them. We see towns walking away.
Okay, the towns have the right to walk away. Well, that's really interesting. Towns can really take power over energy, save a huge amount of money, and contribute to saving the planet. Joseph Goodman, it was really good talking to you, and I think I'd like to do something really very soon to discuss the last point, and it really deserves discussion, how communities can, in fact, in much more detail, the possibilities they have for developing their own local energy supply, but also, of course, being connected to regional and national grids. It seems to me that's also fundamental. And also to have storage, which is regional. Anyway, there are many, many details. You know them. I think we should probably do that again and just focus on that. How does that sound?
Especially for the state of Oregon, community choice aggregation may be a really interesting concept to explore. Fundamentally, CCAs or community choice aggregation disrupt the monopoly positions of incumbent utilities. It puts real power and decision-making into local municipalities, and it often is proven to be the most effective approach to achieving communities and their constituents' desired outcomes, which include energy independence and economic security.
Joseph Goodman, it was so good talking to you, and we'll do it again soon. Thanks a lot.
It was great talking to you today, Bill, and your audience. I hope to join you again in the future. Thanks a lot. Bye.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, that's Portland, 90.7 FM. Later in our program, we're going to hear Desiree Helliger's interview sociologist Rick Scarce. He's the author of the landmark study, Eco Warriors, Understanding the Radical Environmental Movement. He'll be speaking at Washington State University, Vancouver campus on April 8th. They will be talking about his body of work, The History and Future of Radical Environmental Organizing, and his new book, Creating Sustainable Communities, Lessons from the Hudson River Region. But next we have more on the environment and organizing. Lori Mercier talks with Cindy Weisner, National Coordinator of Grassroots Global Justice. And Cindy will also be speaking at WSU, Washington State University campus, Vancouver. So lots going on out there. We'll hear all about it. Lori.
Thanks, Denise. Cindy Weisner is National Coordinator of Grassroots Global Justice, and she has been a community and labor organizer for several decades, working with the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union and the Miami Workers Center, which she represented as a member of the U.S. Social Forum. She currently represents Grassroots Global Justice on the International Council of the World Social Forum. And she will be coming to the Portland-Vancouver area on Friday this week, speaking about frontline communities at COP21 and beyond at the Environmental and Climate Justice Practices Conference held at Washington State University in Vancouver. More on that later. Welcome to KBOO, Cindy Weisner.
Hi, thank you for having me on this morning. I'm really honored to be visiting your parts of the world this coming week.
Yes, and we're very happy to have you here, and we want to tell people a bit about your work. Tell us about the work of Grassroots Global Justice. I understand it was started in San Antonio about a decade ago.
Yes. So Grassroots Global Justice is a multifactorial alliance of about 60 U.S.-based grassroots organizing groups here in that are building power for working and poor people and communities of color. And so we, you know, have been in a long-term process of relationship building, political alignment, and really trying to develop transformational leadership. Our membership it was founded in San Antonio, Texas, 10 years ago, and with the Southwest Workers Union hosting that first membership assembly. And we do work at the intersection of our slogan is no war, no warming, build an economy for the people and the planet. And we try to weave and bridge together U.S.-based organizing groups with international social movements that really tries to work for climate justice, an end to war, and a just transition to a new economy.
So talk about the importance of linking various social movements in this larger movement for climate justice.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, you know, we have always had a lot of the founders of Grassroots Global Justice Alliance are leaders and people that came out of the environmental justice movement here in the United States. And I think that we've always had a very holistic approach to our work. You know, we see many things connected, you know, the root causes of what happens in our communities and then around the world. And so we actively talk about the role of capitalism, the role of patriarchy, the impacts of imperialism, and try to really translate what does that look like in our communities and what does that look like in relationship to the work that we're fighting against, right? But we also are very clear that we have to build up internationalist framework and movement, and that's really important. And here in this country, we have, you know, a very rich history of solidarity amongst people that live in the U.S. with movements around the world. And I think that for us, it's really about this kind of joint struggle perspective, because as we build with, you know, landless peoples in South Africa, or the feminist movement in Brazil, or the folks fighting, you know, military bases in the Philippines, we always try to say, in a lot of ways, these are our counterparts. These are grassroots folks also fighting against the systems of oppression and exploitation in their context, but also they share a common, oftentimes, same enemy, right? Whether it's the U.S. transnational corporation, whether it's a U.S. invasion of their country or occupation, and really trying to build up that that joint struggle perspective.
And certainly capitalism has no boundaries. Global capitalism reaches around the world, as does the ideology of patriarchy and imperialism. But for grassroots groups, it's often difficult to build that kind of internationalism. And so what are some of the obstacles, and how have you overcome some of those obstacles with Grassroots Global Justice?
Yeah, so we were born out of we were born out of the World Social Forum process, and so you know, about more than a decade ago, the first World Social Forum was hosted in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And we took a very loose delegation of grassroots leaders, about 40, to the second World Social Forum. And in that process, I think people got very inspired and also very politicized by who they saw and what they saw. They came face to face with the MST. They came face to face with different leaders, you know, from working class folks. And one of the pieces that, you know, we were challenged by, and that was also at the height of you know, George Bush Jr. and his war in Iraq. And part of what people sort of were grateful was that, hey, here are some organizers in the United States that get the global implication of the role of the United States around the world. But they're like, you know, and it's great that you guys are organizing in terms of the root causes that, you know, whether it's environmental justice, housing, migration issues, you all need to do something about the role of your government. And so I think that was taken very seriously, and we want to be able to develop, you know, the capacity for grassroots organizers and organizations to engage strategically with movements abroad. And we do that intentionally by bringing leaders together, you know, whether it's the fight against the WTO, the trade agreement fights, to the World Social Forum or to like what happened in Paris in December, the UN Convention on Climate Change. And so part of that is being able to talk about what is that, you know, how are popular movements coming together, sharing, cross-sharing strategies, cross-sharing visions, and then also how to infuse that and bring that back into your local work and regional work, right? And I think the difficulty is that, you know, it's expensive, it's time-consuming, but it's language often is one of our biggest, you know, issues that we have to prepare for. And but I think that for us, it's really important to bring representatives from low-income, indigenous communities of color that are at the front line of these issues to actually intersect and talk directly with social movements from around the world.
Great. And one of the projects of Grassroots Global Justice has been the Climate Justice Alliance and the Our Power campaign. Do you want to talk a bit about the Our Power campaign, which I find interesting, does not have the word climate justice in its name?
Well, yes. So we are known. We did Grassroots Global Justice, along with many other organizations, helped co-found the Climate Justice Alliance. And part of the work of the Climate Justice Alliance is it also launched the Our Power campaign, Communities United for a Just Transition. And because I think we see, it's becoming clearer and clearer that we need systemic solutions, you know, to both the causes and impacts of climate change, and that those solutions must also come from the most impacted folks. You know, whether it's peasants, small-scale farmers, indigenous peoples, other low-income folks, communities of color, you know, kind of at the front line of the extractive economy and climate change, we are pretty clear that we need to be able to intersect not only the solution, but fundamentally the solutions to climate has to be connected to understanding the economy, right? And so for us, we're clear that in our communities, we have a long history of fighting what shorthand I'll say against the bat, right? Whether it's incinerators, coal mining companies, nuclear plants. But what we have to also pivot into is what are we fighting for?
So not just fighting against the power and capitalism and these environmental degradation, but also providing models or a vision for something different.
That's right. And I think that part of the kind of bottom-up approach is that we've chosen 7 sites that are just transition demonstration sites, right? From Richmond, California, the organizing that APEN, the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Communities for a Better Environment have been leading against the fight against Chevron, for example, and the refinery there, or Black Mesa Water Coalition and their struggle against Peabody Coal Company. And, you know, we have 5 other sites around the country in Appalachia, in Eastern Benham, in Kentucky, in a Cooperation Jackson, being led by Co-op Jackson, Detroit, Michigan, led by ENIAC. And so part of it is that the conditions are very different. And then the examples of extractive industries is also very different. And like I said, those fights, those communities have been having those struggles and that organizing for a longer period of time. But why they were so invested in being a just transition demonstration site is because they also want to be able to demonstrate, well, what is it that we want to put instead, right? What is it that we want to, what's the vision of a different economy? Because many times those communities are completely tied to those big corporations. They're like company towns in a lot of way. And I think that part of that reality is not just sufficient to say shut down the plant or shut down this company. It's actually what are we trying to transition towards and have a real strategy about what that looks like with economic plans, with local governance, that we think about all of these components along the way so that we can be offering something very qualitatively, something different to the communities there.
Could you give us just a quick example of one of these transition demonstration projects, what one of those looks like?
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I could talk about, you know, in Black Mesa, on the Navajo Reservation, Navajo and Hopi Reservation, you know, they want to create a native-owned solar. You know, right now, the Navajo Nation provides energy and water basically to places like Los Angeles, you know, places in Arizona and like Las Vegas. And so they've been, you know, campaigning to try to see if, you know, they actually stop the Peabody Coal Company and that extraction of their own natural resources. How can they be able to have an alternative source of energy, right? A different source of energy that also, ironically, it's like majority of people on the Navajo reservation actually don't have running water and don't have electricity. And so, but here they are providing electricity for these mega towns, you know, like Las Vegas or cities, mega cities like Las Vegas and Los Angeles and parts of Arizona. And so I think those are some of the examples. They are also going through a process of, you know, culturally trying to reconnect back to some of their traditions around sheep herding and creating wool. Food, you know, creating again sort of food sovereignty, food justice models, and being able to utilize the campaign as a way to be able to connect back to ways that Navajo and people had been historically, you know, a lot of that has been challenged by the extractive model, you know, sort of like the disconnection from culture, the disconnection from their heritage.
And Cindy, I might point out that the Grassroots Global Justice website has a great little film about the Black Mesa Project. And thank you so much for joining us today. Cindy Weissner is the National Coordinator of Grassroots Global Justice. She will be here in Vancouver, across the river from Portland, on Friday, April 8th. She'll be speaking about climate justice on at the Washington State University Vancouver campus. You can go online to the WSU website and find out more about directions and where to go. But that will be Friday from 10 until 4 p.m. Along with Cindy Weissner will be Gail Small of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe speaking about climate justice in Indian Country, and Rick Scarce coming up next on The Old Mole, who will be talking about the radical environmentalism. And for more about the work of Grassroots Global Justice, go to the website ggjalliance.org and the ourpowercampaign.org. Thanks again, Cindy.
Thank you so much for having me, and looking forward to being at the Washington State University on Friday. So thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Just one thing, baby, just before you go, just one thing, baby. Before you go, there's gonna be judgment in the morning. There's gonna be judgment in the morning. There's gonna be judgment in the morning. Yes, baby. Yes, baby. You're gonna reap for what you sow.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer, and that was Diamanda Galas with Reap What You Sow. Desiree Helgers is here with us. She will be talking with sociologist Rick Scarce. We're going to just get right into it and talk more about the environment and environmentalism Desiree?
So my guest today is Rick Scares, who, along with our last guest, Sydney Wisner, will be speaking at WSU Vancouver on April 8th at a day-long conference on environmental justice and climate justice practices. The event begins at 10 and runs until 4:30, so we'll put a link up on the Old Moles page with more information. Speaking alongside Sydney Wisner and Rick Scares is Gail Small, head chief woman, renowned Northern Cheyenne environmental lawyer and activist, who will be speaking on climate justice in Indian Country. The event is free and open to the public. I also want to take a moment this morning to plug another related event at WSU Vancouver coming up on April 12th. Is a panel on the fight to stop the Pacific Northwest from becoming a toxic fossil fuel transport corridor. And that panel will include Wilbur Slokish Jr., hereditary chief of the Klickitat Nation, Cager Claybaugh, vice president of ILU Local 4, Emerald Ingram of Portland Rising Tide, Alona Steinke, activist with the Sierra Club, Columbia River Keeper, and Friends of the Columbia Gorge, and Clark County activist Robin White. A reception and tabling will follow the event. And then at 7 p.m. to 8:30, comedian economist Yoram Bauman will be speaking on comedy, economics, and carbon taxes in Washington State. Bauman is the founder of Carbon Washington, the Yes on I-732 revenue neutral carbon tax proposal. Again, that's WSU Vancouver on April 12th. And finally, I want to put in a quick plug for the April 14th screening of Robert Lundahl's film, Who Are My People, which focuses on Native communities in the Mojave Desert fighting to protect their lands from encroachment by massive solar farms. Lundahl will be on hand for the screening, which begins at 7 p.m. So again, my guest today is Rick Scares, who's a professor of sociology at Skidmore College and the author of four books, including the book Eco Warriors, Understanding the Radical Environmental Movement, which is a landmark study of environmental direct action, published in 1990 and reissued in 2007. So he'll be speaking this coming Friday on the topic of Trajectories of Injustice, Three Decades of Radical Environmentalism. In 1992, in the aftermath of an animal liberation action at a research lab at WSU Pullman, the FBI attempted to coerce Scares to reveal the sources for his book. Scares, who was a graduate student at the time, famously refused to divulge his sources, and as a result of his refusal, spent, I think, 5 months in jail for contempt of court. The battle to protect his sources became the focus of his 2005 book, Contempt of Court, A Scholar's Battle for Free Speech from Behind Bars. His latest book is Creating Sustainable Communities, Lessons from the Hudson River Region. Thank you for joining us today, Rick.
Thanks so much for having me, Desiree.
Yeah, so looking back, your book, Eco Warriors, really captures the sense of urgency that so many environmental activists were already feeling 25 years ago. Notably, in the past week, we saw the release of a new study projecting that sea levels could rise between 5 and 6 feet by 2100. So it's a bit sobering to look back at your 1990 book, which was published, you know, only a year after Bill McKibben's The End of Nature and just barely in the wake of the May 1990 car bombing that nearly killed Earth First activist Judy Berry along with Daryl Cherney. In the conclusion of the book, you take have a quote from Berry, and it's a pretty bleak assessment in terms of the future of the planet. And one of the concluding passages from the book, you write that the sometimes crude, always scrappy, stop-at-nothing people in the radical environmental movement are all but certain that time has been used up, that hope is lost. Yet they persevere. They are possessed, cursed by the most basic of animal drives to survive. So the question really is, what do you see as the lessons and legacy of radical environmentalism in the 1970s and 80s, particularly in an era in which so many communities are engaging in direct action to try to save their lands from encroachment by fossil fuel companies?
Desiree, I think you just put your finger on it. So many people in so many places really are taking it upon themselves to act. I happen to be in Pennsylvania today, in the heart of fracking country, in at least this region of the country. And, you know, there are people in every community that I pass through who have fought fracking, who have refused to give in to the enticement of huge dollars and so forth and so on. It's happening even in my neighborhood, 3 miles away from me. A pipeline which will exist only to take fracked gas from Pennsylvania to probably New Hampshire to a port there where it can be unloaded to tankers and be sent anywhere in the world. my neighbors are fighting that pipeline. So, in terms of really embracing hope and fighting for it, that's what people are doing. It's not simply a group of eco-warriors out there who are doing it. We've all metaphorically got camouflage on now. We're all fighting this fight across the country. If this planet does indeed go down, it's not going to go down without a tremendous fight from people everywhere who care deeply, not only about what's happening in their neighborhoods, but that's what's happening across the country, across the continent, and all over the planet.
Yeah, so can you speak a little bit about some of the struggles that are particularly going on in the Hudson River region, which is the focus of your new book?
Yeah. Not only are my neighbors in the little town of Nassau fighting a compressor plant that is so large that if it were to explode, natural gas compressor plant, it would incinerate everything within a mile to 2 miles of the plant. It would be as if a small nuclear bomb, in terms of destructive capacity, as if a small nuclear weapon had gone off. The same thing is happening south of me by about 2 hours. In Westchester County, very, very well-to-do suburb immediately north of New York City, where folks are fighting yet another natural gas pipeline. There's a third natural gas pipeline that, and this is really bizarre, I want you to imagine a natural gas pipeline running down the middle of Interstate 5 for 200 miles, so maybe from Seattle to Portland. Imagine that. That's exactly what has been proposed for Interstate 87, also known as the New York Thruway. Just an outrageous, incredible kind of plan that no one thinks is advisable, and that is wrong on so many counts. But first and foremost, it's wrong because it's all about frack gas, and we desperately need to leave it in the ground. So, that's just one family of activism that's going on. Real quickly, there's another that's really fascinating to me and is of immediate relevance to what we'll be talking about on Friday at the WSU conference, and that is folks up and down the Hudson region, throughout the Hudson region, are fighting environmental injustice. It's a struggle that in some ways began in the Bronx, immediately adjacent to and in part overlapping into the Hudson River region, 10, 15 years ago, when a brilliant activist named Majora Carter got Sustainable South Bronx going. But there are so many other environmental justice organizations that exist all throughout the region. And I would say along with fracking, environmental justice work is first and foremost in terms of what's happening throughout the region.
Yeah, so it's interesting to look at the fact that your book came out just a year before the National People of Color's Environmental Summit of 1991. Mm-hmm. And while we can sort of look at some of the influence that some of the more radical direct action had in the Pacific Northwest, the question too might be, what are some of the other influences that that the civil rights movement and other organizing within communities of color have had on kind of building these strategies of direct action. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the organizing of We Act and Sustainable South Bronx?
Sure. Yeah, you just mentioned We Act, which is featured in my new book, which you mentioned, Creating Sustainable Communities, which is really, the book is about the remarkable things that are happening in the 315-mile length of the Hudson River from its source on Mount Marcy, which is the highest peak in the Adirondack Mountains. I'm not going to tell you how high because it's embarrassing compared to the mountains you can see right outside your window. But from Mount Marcy to Manhattan, there are some of the most fascinating, worthwhile, vital, not only activism, but series of actions, public policy, farming, you name it, is going on there in such rich, rich ways that I felt it made a wonderful case study for what every region in the nation could be like. But certainly one of the hallmarks of this region has been its environmental activism. So if I might, not only let me talk about environmental justice, but really this, in a super thumbnail, this the history of environmental activism in the region, and I'll get to environmental justice in just one second. But in important ways, the environmental movement as we know it now, as we experience it, got started in the Hudson River region when a group of really of commercial fishers, anglers, who would crab, who would fish for striped bass and so forth, vociferously opposed a plan by Consolidated Edison, which is the power company to this day for New York City, to create a 9 billion, with a B, 9 billion gallon reservoir on the top of a beautiful, beautiful mountain that juts straight out of the Hudson River called Storm King. This reservoir would have been filled each night when electrical power is cheap, and of course pumping water uphill is not an economic prospect that any sane organization would adopt, but we're talking about Consolidated Edison, so sanity and Con Ed don't really go well together.
And what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1962 was when this proposal was first made. So the idea was to pump water up to this $9 billion gallon reservoir almost immediately adjacent to West Point, if that helps orient people regarding where we're talking about here, immediately north of the military academy at West Point. And then during the daytime, when the electricity demand was very high, they would simply release the water through tubes and send it down to turbines, just like dams on the Columbia, and spin turbines and produce electricity. Well, folks fought that proposal for more than 10 years and ultimately were successful. And it was one of several things, along with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and a number of other important activist moments in the 1960s and very early 70s, that really brought us the environmental movement, the true movement, not the big interest groups here. I'm not talking about Sierra Club and Wilderness Society, but the actual grassroots movement that we know today in environmentalism. And so jumping ahead now to the late 70s, early 80s, the WEAC story is really a fascinating one. The New York City Department of Sanitation decided to build a new sewage treatment plant in Manhattan, and they figured what better place to put it than the path by following the path of least resistance, which happened to be West Harlem. Of course, it was then, as it is now, a community of color predominantly, and they succeeded in establishing a sewage treatment plant there, bulldozing all resistance. And the sewage treatment plant handles all of the sewage on the island of Manhattan north of Chelsea. So it's just a huge amount of waste being funneled to this plant. No provisions at all were made to remedy to abate the intense smells that
Rick, we have about two more minutes.
Yeah, sure. And so a group of activists led by a brilliant woman named Peggy Shepherd literally stopped traffic on the West Side Highway in New York City. They were arrested. They were called the Sewage Seven. And they ultimately succeeded in forcing the city to install millions and millions of dollars of noxious abatement equipment so that people in West Harlem can breathe easy. So that's the kind of thing that's going on now, and that really is a hallmark of the environmental justice movement.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's striking about the success of groups like WEACT and Sustainable South Bronx is that the better job they do, you know, the more effective they are in protecting their neighborhoods and creating green, kind of sustainable neighborhoods, the more likely they are to come up against kind of the force of gentrification and other interests that really want to profit off the organizing work that they've done. And perhaps, as they're building that leadership, they're going to need to use that organizing, the same organizing strategies to try to beat back some of those interests that are then going to want to basically colonize their neighborhoods.
Well, that's exactly right. They've got to be creative with regard to public policies that ensure that people who are in those neighborhoods can continue to live in them. They're the ones who bring life to those places, not folks who are coming from outside with a whole lot of money and are looking for the next chic area to live. That's a real concern in South Bronx, and it's so tragic. That's the poorest congressional district in the United States of America, and to compound injustice upon injustice is abhorrent to anyone who cares, broadly speaking, about our neighbors.
Yeah, I just want to note also that the book's focus, I think, there's a section on architectural preservation, building preservation, and the sort of fight to kind of stop this program that Bloomberg had, which would have basically demolished about 20% of New York's buildings within the space of, I think, 20 years, is a really interesting and relevant chapter for Portland organizers who are, you know, we're now seeing this kind of wave of demolitions in Portland. And you really, I think, make that point very effectively that, you know, preserving the buildings is the most sustainable practice. And this question of how sustainable can a city be that is undergoing this kind of pace of demolition that we're seeing in Portland, I think is a really, really important implication of the work that you do in connection with that struggle in New York City. So I want to thank you so much. Rick Scarce, professor of sociology at Skidmore College, he's going to be in the area on April 8th, speaking at WSU Vancouver alongside Cindy Wisner and Gail Small. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Desiree, for having me.
That's Tune Yards, My Country. I really recommend actually checking that whole album out. It's very interesting. But the Old Mole, we try to mix it up here. Desiree, thank you. Lori, Mercier, both of you sitting here with me in the studio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris, and Patricia Kohlberg is our fearless engineer this morning. Let me tell you what's going on KBOO later this morning at 10 o'clock. It's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Her guest today is Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham with Sightline Institute, presenting an update on the fossil fuel industry in the Pacific Northwest. At 11, Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Guest Dr. Kelly Brogan, author of the book A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio with our host, Will Hall. We'll hear voices and visions from outside mental health. Like I said, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. There was a lot of announcements regarding the event at WSU, and I wanted to just remind folks that you can find out more information at events.vancouver.wsu.edu. That's a lot, actually. / environmental and climate justice practices. There probably is an easier path to find that stuff, but we do post the show, so you can listen again and get that information, or just call us over here at KBOO and we'll let you know what's going on. We're wrapping it up this morning. I do want to thank our guests. It's a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Bill Resnick and Joseph Goodman, Desiree Helligers, Rick Scarce, and Lori Mercier and Cindy Wisner, a national coordinator of Grassroots Global Justice. Thanks again. We'll be back next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bitter 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.